Is he's a saber man? I mean, how many people know what saber is?
Part two.
Okay. Great.
All right.
Great. The rest of you people, you're here because you love baseball. You're going to love it even better if you ever become a Sabre member. Go ahead.
All right. I've been in Sabre. It's the Society for American Baseball Research, SABR. And I've been in it since 1976. I met Tony Lupien, who you may remember, who was the scout for the Braves, but he was mainly known as the Dartmouth coach, who coached Jim Beattie, Chuck Selbach, and a third pitcher that made the big leagues. And he also played for the Red Sox and the Phillies and the White Sox in the 40s. And Sabre is the one time I was quoted in Sports Illustrated, I got a quote of the week at a Sabre convention. They call us baseball nuts, but they forget that a nut is a very fine fruit. That was almost 30 years ago. You couldn't say that today without getting somebody, you know. So I did The Perfect Irons, my first book that was with Tony, and we met at Sabre, and then the Branch Rickey book I did 4 years ago won Sabre's Seymour Medal. And they Ernestine Miller is here tonight. He's a Sabre member, and every January, or it's more February.
January 28th.
There's a authors meet at the public library again.
You finish and I'll give my little plug.
All right. And so it's membership is still inexpensive. I think it's only $60 a year. And you get a lot of publications. I have articles on scouts in the last two publications, one on Billy and one on the Dodger scouts. And I have one on Herb Stein coming out, and there's a new book on scouting that should be out at the end of the year called, with a great title, Can He Play? Which is the questions that all of you ask in the field. So thank you for the opportunity, Lou.
Sabre is a great organization. I only found out about it about 10 or 12 years ago. I can imagine that most of the people that are in baseball don't even know about it. And you get publications from them at least three or four a year that you get no place else. You get it with your dues that you pay. And who wrote the book on the Dodgers?
Well, Roger Kahn, The Boys of Summer.
No. For Sabre.
Oh, it was. Well, I was in that. It's called The Endless Seasons, about Dodgers. And
did you write that book?
Well, I have an article in it, but I think we might be talking about it. There had been so much written on the Dodgers. I'm not sure if Sabre did a book on the Dodgers, but their last issue of the National Pastime was called Endless Seasons.
Can I say a word about Herb Stein
that
I failed to say before when we were talking about Manny? Herb was a great scout, not just a scout, but for $55,000, he signed eight players to the major leagues. Eight.
Rod Carew, the most famous, Frank Viola.
Gene Larkin.
Scott Carew.
I mean, yeah. Now, in the draft that Manny was in, Herb was working for the Twins. He wanted Manny back because Herb knew a hitter when he saw a hitter. And he said, that guy is going to be one of the best you ever did see, Joe. Well, anyways, he couldn't convince his people, and they had the eighth pick in the draft. The eighth pick, and Manny went on the 13th pick.
Who did they take? You remember who they took?
They took a pitcher that never got out
they
of.
They got somebody that never made it.
But he didn't even get out of the lower league either. He hurt himself real fast, and he was done. But Herb, and the Twins organization sort of parted their ways at that time.
Well, after the strike of 94,
they were never friendly
off.
Again. Yeah.
You know.
And I'll tell you this. We were friends, and every time Manny would do something good, Herb would see me at a game and say, Manny Ramirez. And he never took it like a bitter pill. And to me, he's a great guy.
Well, one of his great sayings is the moment a player is signed, he becomes a better player. Because the monkey's off his back. You know, he's a pro. And, you know, that's what I've always loved about the scouts I've met, that you're realist, but you're optimist, you know. And in a game, like another of Herb's colleagues was Alice Clary, who I'm sure, you know, who was one of the great characters I ever met.
I knew
you know, from I'm from Valdosta, Georgia, and it's football country. Yeah. They wouldn't know a baseball player down there from a crate of pineapples.
I'll tell you something. You probably know this. Ellis Clary had two lives. Not wives, lives.
Mm.
He died. He died on the table.
In the
oh, that's right.
And they brought him back to life.
And Ellis Clary, I don't know if it was him, but it was one of the older scouts who, when he was suffering a heart attack, told the ambulance driver to get the mileage.
Get the mileage.
And when they... And when they went to a funeral of another colleague, they said, what did he die of? You know, cancer, heart disease? No, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. All right, let's throw it open to questions.
Well, I am a member of SABR. Before I was a member of SABR, I was a professional. And George Mack told me to go down to Virgil Trucks Baseball School. I was supposed to get a tryout with the Cardinals at Baldwin, Georgia, but I went to Virgil Trucks Baseball School, and Art Revel signed me. Imagine Zach Taylor, because he was a scout there, but Revel was managing St. Petersburg. Then I wound up in, when they had a problem with the Buick, they sent me to Buick, and I hit 315, and we won a pennant World Series, and the playoffs. And it was so nice to hear you two say that baseball was better then, in this area, than now. And I'm very sorry that I quit. After 3 years, I broke my ankle in my middle year. But I was 299 over 3 years, and I had an on-base percentage of 448, which I was going to say. So I'm very sorry that I didn't stay with the game, because I was not released. But I was a little guy. We were talking about that.
And, how many minor league teams were there when you played?
Well, in
your organization?
Well, White Sox had about 5-6 teams. Okay. Let's see, there was Duke, Madisonville, got folded. And then there was Duluth, then there was Waterloo, there was Colorado Springs, and Memphis was a working agreement. Okay. That was it.
So it's pretty much the same as it is today, but years and years ago, some of these minor league systems would have maybe 15 teams or whatever it might be. It was so difficult to get to the big leagues. That's and right. At that time, you didn't have minor league free agency.
No.
So if you were signed to a certain organization, let's say if you were with the Yankee organization and you had Mickey Mantle playing center field and you had whoever it might be in left field or first base, and you were stuck behind a star, you were a career minor leaguer.
Nellie
you
Fox.
You were in the wrong organization.
I was a second baseman. Nellie Fox was at the White Sox, and then I was at the Pirates for a little while. Mazeroski.
Yeah.
But I still, who knows? I remember my first year, I made the All-Star team, and I hit 315. It's 316. I thought it says 315. So I go to spring training next year. Ira Hutchinson was my manager, the pitcher for the Braves in the 30s. And he says, kid, finish college. You got limited natural ability. He says, and I was his bread and butter man. He said, he was my bread. He used to introduce me to Conway, a manager who also played for the Giants. Get finish college, right? They made up their mind in a certain sense right away. But you know, it still bothers me that I left.
Sure.
You know, but it was so good to hear you say that about baseball was better then in this area.
Thank you. Yeah.
First of all, Jay, thank you very much for this evening. This has been the best one of all.
Thank you.
But I'm listening here, and I appreciate everything that you say, but I have something that's not clear in my head. I guess, and it may be different for each of you, the relationship between the scout and the front office. How far can you gentlemen go in actually signing somebody? You talk about being there to give them a ticket to go fly.
Oh no!
You have to keep in touch with them and say, "Hey, look, I saw one game and he went 3-for-5, but the next game I saw it." Are you in constant touch with them?
Yes. First of all, a player has to be drafted by your organization.
That's not your team. That's the front office.
No. Wait.
Okay.
We go out. Let's say the scouting season begins each spring, and it'll start, let's say, in February, depending upon what part of the country you're in. Joe and myself, being from the Northeast, we would start our season down in Florida. We would go down there, and see some of the local kids, but more so we would see the Northeast schools that would come down to Florida, and we would see them play under better weather conditions. And then we would be down there for basically a month, and we would come back at the end of March when the weather would change up here and they would start to play their league games up here.
You haven't approached any player yet?
No, you're not allowed. All you can do is you can go scout the player, you can hand the player a questionnaire to get information from him, you can talk to the parents, but you don't have any rights to go and sign that player. You have to wait until the June draft. It's usually the first week in June, and then your organization and his organization and his organization gets an opportunity to draft the player. Once your club drafts a particular player, you're the only team that can talk to him. So I can love, let's say, Manny Ramirez, which I did, but Joe with the Cleveland Indians had the only right to talk to him. And I was very close with Manny. And I told, because I'm very close with Mel Zitta, Mel and I are very close friends. And I told him, if when the time comes, the day of the draft, if you're not drafted by the Chicago Cubs, it doesn't have to be Manny, it could be anybody. And you tell these players that when the time comes, if you're not the club that drafts that particular player, please don't call me. I may be a friend of the family, but I cannot talk to you until the day you sign, because you can get hit with tampering charges. But what happens is, when your club drafts that particular player, your scouting director will contact you and tell you to go into the house and basically tell you what to offer that player, what you can sign and what your range is. Right. And you can get to a point where you're close, so you get on the phone to that scouting director and say, I need another 5,000 or 10,000. Now, you may get a situation where it may be only $5,000 or 10,000, and I've been in the game a long time, and Joe's been in the game a long time, where we have the authority to say, okay, I'll give you the extra 5,000. But I'll tell you what, years ago when I signed Jamie Moyer, and that was in 1984, bonuses were a lot different. First round picks got 100,000. Second round picks got between 60 and 80,000. Third round picks got maybe 35 to 60,000. The hardest rounds to sign were always rounds 6 through 10, because after the 10th round, everybody got $1,000. It's not like that today. Now, I drafted Jamie in the 6th round at the time. And I go in the house, and at the time, there were only two scouts that liked him, me and a scout named Joe Riley from the Philadelphia Phillies. He's an old detective in Philadelphia, and like Joe had said, he didn't get too friendly with many people, but he liked me. And Joe had gone into Jamie's house the week before the draft to get what we call signability. You would call a player up, you want to find out if the player wants to sign, and you can't throw a figure at him because you don't know if you're going to get him in the draft or where you're going to get him. You could maybe put a player in the 5th round and he doesn't get drafted till the 15th. And if you tell that player, I'm going to give you $25,000, and now you get him in the 15th round and he's going to get $1,000 or whatever it might be, you know, your goose is cooked. So I go into Jamie's house to go sign him. And I have, at the time, $10,000 for a 6th-round pick. You can't even get a college senior today for $10,000. But I go in with $10,000.
Does he still talk to you?
Who?
Moyer?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you a story to sign him. What happened? So I go in with $10,000. And Jamie says to me, we're sitting at the table, I'm sitting at the head of the table here. His mom's sitting here, his dad's here, and Jamie's right there. And I offer $10,000. And Jamie says to me, well, Mr. Riley sat at this table last week and said if he drafted me, he would give me $12,000. And I'm going to myself, thank God he didn't say 15 or 20, because then I'd be in trouble. But he said he would give me $12,000. So I said to him, would you sign for $12,000? He said, yeah. And at that time, you had one phone call. It's not like today, you're bargaining back and forth, you keep getting on the phone with the agent or whatever, and you keep calling your scouting director and say they want this, they want that. At that time, you got one phone call. And to even give a player an extra $500, you had to make that phone call. You couldn't give him any of the money. And I was a young scout then, so I didn't have any authority or anything. So I said to Jamie, if I make this one phone call that I have, will you sign for the $12,000? And he said, well, I don't know. You know, you're telling me that I'm one of the new players. Dallas Green came in 82, and that's when I came in, and you're starting to build a system and this and that. I'd really like 15. So I looked at him across the table, and I said, you know, I don't think you really want to sign. When you figure out what you want to do, you just told me you would take 12. Now you're telling me you want 15. Before I know it, you're going to tell me you want 20. I'm leaving. And I go like this to get up, and an arm reaches across the table, and it's his mother. His mother grabs my arm and says, Mr. Blitzer, don't get excited. Please sit down. Don't worry, he'll sign. So I look at Jamie across the table, and I say to him, are you going to sign for the $12,000 if I make that phone call? And he says, yeah, don't leave. Please, don't leave. Well, what happened was I signed Jamie for the $12,000 that night. And the next morning, at that time, we used to have to sign the contract and put it in the post office and get signed receipt when it gets delivered to Chicago. So I stayed over that night at a hotel, and I took him for breakfast, and he took me over to the post office, and we mailed a contract, and he was really happy, and the family was happy. And as I left, I said to him, now just remember, you're not a strikeout pitcher, just keep the ball down, and let's hope for the best. So he goes out to the New York Penn League that year, makes the All-Star team, and leads the league in strikeouts. He calls me up, and he says, I thought you told me I'm not a strikeout pitcher. Well, Jamie got to the big leagues in a year and a half. I had two players, those were the quickest, him and a player named Gary Scott from Pelham, New York. And they both got to the big leagues in a year and a half, and they, believe it or not, they both had the same college coach. Jamie came out of St. Joe's, and Gary came out of Villanova. But when Jamie made the big leagues, they were playing the Mets. And they were at a hotel here in New York, and I go up to see him, and I'm going to take him for lunch. And Gary Varsha was his roommate. Gary Varsha was the bench coach with the Phillies. And at that time, they would put two rookies in a room together. So I'm sitting there, and they have one bed here and a bed over there. And I'm sitting in a chair, and Gary Varsha sitting there, and Jamie sitting on the bed over there. And I tell Gary the same story I just told you people. And Jamie's sitting on the bench, and he says, Billy, I've never asked you this question, but I have to ask it now. I said, what's your question? He said, if you left my house that day, would have you come back to sign him? I said, sure, and you would have got your $15,000.
Yeah.
You've been talking about signability a couple of times tonight, and one of the big issues in the current collective bargaining negotiations is draft slotting. And I just wanted to know how you guys think draft slotting would affect signability. It sounds like it's one of the Bud Selig really wants to put draft slotting into the CBA, and it sounds like that's what's going to happen. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on how that would affect signability.
Joe, you want to take that, or I can answer it? But go ahead.
Okay.
Okay. Signability, the draft slotting. By them doing that, it's not going to affect it a great deal. All these kids today have agents. They all want big money. And what's happened in the past number of years is that kids, what they say, slide in the draft. You get a player that might have fifth round, sixth round ability, and they want $1 million. So what happens is they're not drafted in the first round to get that $1 million. So they slide a club like my club did it this year. We drafted a kid named Maples out of North Carolina, a high school pitcher. Now, he wanted, I think it was, he got $2 million, $2.5 million. He wanted that kind of money because of his signability. He slid. He was probably a late first-round pick, but he slid out of the first round, and because of the money, and he was supposed to go to University of North Carolina. He was also a football player, a kicker, and he was committed to go play football and baseball at the University of North Carolina, which is one of your biggest schools in the country. And he slid to the 12th round, and we took a flyer on him. And with our new ownership, they said, draft him. If we can, we'll get him signed. And we ended up giving him $2.5 million in the 12th round. We also drafted this year in the 11th round, I think it was, Sean Dunstan Jr. I signed Sean. And we drafted his son. And his son, I didn't see him because I was on the pro side. But they said he was a player that could have got taken between the second and the fifth round, and we gave him $1.1 million, and he slid because of it. So what you were having, we hadn't done this before, but the Yankees are known to do it. They took Devin Betances in the eighth round and gave him $1 million. And the Red Sox have been known to do it. And what was happening was the draft was created so the teams, as you see, with the lesser records pick first and the better teams pick later. And the agents in the last 10 years or so have circumvented the draft. They've had their players that they represent say that they want X amount of dollars, trying to steer them to the clubs, to the richer clubs. So that's why Commissioner Selig is trying to get a draft slot so this doesn't happen.
But the union's not going to go for it.
The union's probably not going to go for it because they don't want any kind of salary cap. But what I was reading in the paper today, which you've been reading, it seems like they're going to come to an agreement. Rather than have draft slotting on each particular round, they're going to have so-called slotting. They're going to give a club a figure for 10 rounds. And you can spend it any way you want. But after that, some kids are still going to slide. Some kids are still going to slide past the 10th round, and you're going to get clubs that have money, probably my own, and probably the Red Sox, and probably the Yankees. I know not the Cardinals. They're going to take guys down the line, and they're going to give them $1 million or whatever it might be so they can continue to get the better players. I don't know what the answer is. I really don't.
So you've all made reference to the big money nowadays, and at the same time you mentioned how the scouting network's been reduced as for cost savings. Wondering why that would be, you think
you're right.
You think you invest in your profession.
You're absolutely right. With the money that we give out today, there's a lot of mistakes made because you're not getting as many looks. You're not getting to know those players the way we used to know the players.
So why aren't they investing in your profession?
That's a good question. They're taking the money away from us and they're putting it into the signing of the players. That's what's happening.
With the recent changes in your organization, Joe, I'm going to align you with Cleveland and the Antonetti getting bumped up, and Joe as well. Congratulations to your team, your franchise for its success.
Thank you.
How have those changes in the front office impacted your ability to go out and do your job as a scout, from a scouting philosophy by organization?
Well, I've been through many changes through the years being with the Cubs, but right now, I've been through about five or six general managers in the 30 years that I've been there, and every time that you change general managers, they usually bring in a different scouting director or they bring somebody else in, and the philosophy in the organization changes. When Dallas Green came in, Gordon Goldsberry was the man that hired me. And as you look at the Phillies today, they came from the Philly organization. And we would draft a lot of high school players with what they call tools. At that time, we had to run every position player in the 60-yard dash to get a 60-yard time. If we didn't have a 60-yard time, they wouldn't draft them for you. But we would draft high school kids. And Joe McElvain, when he was with the Mets, would draft high school kids. And you would put those kids in your system, and high school kids, you have to let them play 5 and 6 years sometimes even 7 years, and let them develop, because sometimes the light bulb doesn't go off for that period of time. Where you get some other clubs will draft more college players, and they call them safe picks. But the difference is, when you take a high school kid, the ceiling may be higher. So you may have a chance to draft that all-star player, where if you're drafting the safe college player, you may be getting a guy that gets to the big leagues, but he may be the 20th player on your roster or somebody that's not going to be the big star. So it depends upon the kind of person that you have sitting at the top. As far as right now, we brought in Theo Epstein, he's going to be the head of baseball operations. We brought in Jed Hoyer as our GM. They brought in Jason McLeod, who's going to head scouting and player development. And then we just hired this past week a new director of pro scouting. And Timmy Wilkin, who did both, is just going to be the amateur. And the way they have it, we have a lot of bosses. I know a good deal of people in baseball, but I don't know any of my bosses. I've never met them. I haven't spoken to them. The only person I've spoken to this past week, we hired a director of pro scouting, and I was the first person that he called because he knows I've been there a long time. And I know a good deal, and he wanted to talk to me, and I happened to meet him this past year in spring training out in Arizona. So we had a little relationship. I met him at a couple of ball games, so he knew me. But when you change at the top, the whole philosophy of the organization can change. And I don't know where it's going yet because they've only been there about 2 weeks. So I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
Thank you. You gentlemen are treasures, and I really enjoyed listening to you. And I'd like about 20 questions for each of you. But one question I would have would be touch briefly on collegiate scouting, the ACC, SEC hotbeds of baseball. Is there a lot of emphasis in watching these guys, or do you already know about them? Is there less scouting than that?
Go ahead, John.
Well, collegiate scouting, I mean, typically you're going to have an older player from high school, so you hope that the player who has gone to college becomes a little bit more mature and, you know, plays in a, what you just said, different conferences in the country can be rated a little bit stronger. No different than maybe, you know, you hear some of the football conferences, but that doesn't discount somebody who's playing in the Big East as opposed to the SEC or the ACC, you know, things like that, or, you know, the MAC conference, the WAC. I mean, as far as a scout, you know, I go to the games, I'm trying to evaluate the talent and the ability of that player. Now, certainly if they're playing in a highly competitive conference, that says something about that. But, you know, there have been many players that play in the big leagues that, you know, don't come from the classic, you know, conferences that everybody rates, you know, so high. I mean, in fact, even the Cardinals, you know, with us, Chris Carpenter was signed out of a high school out of New Hampshire. So, I mean, and he was, you know, nobody's going to tell me that player, that pitcher there doesn't have the intestinal fortitude to be a great athlete. And Jason Mott, like you said, came from Iona College, you know, out here. So there have been many players in the North that may not play in some of the other conferences that are deemed maybe that in warmer weather. You know, one of the things that wasn't mentioned, and that's fine, but you know, you're talking about colleges. That college landscape, to me, has somewhat leveled a little bit, because the schools down south and the colleges down there have to play the same number of games as the colleges up here. I believe that Division I is 56. So, you know, maybe 20, 25 years ago, they would play 150 games, and they'd play 50 games up here. So you'd say, well, they have a distinct advantage. Now, the NCAA has leveled the entire playing field where they play the same number of games as the Division I colleges up here. Now, I'm not saying that they don't play, certainly, you know, competitive conferences like you just said, SEC and ACC and some of those other conferences in Texas, but they play the same number of games.
And they've deaded the bat, too. And
that's
made a great difference, you know, that the aluminum bat is not what it used to be.
Right.
Thank
God.
I have to leave, please.
Joe, thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me. Thanks, all of
you. Okay. Yeah.
You mentioned Saber, and I've always been interested because I read the autobiography of Leo Garocha, and he described how he put together a team, and he was famous for putting together winners. And it seemed it was more like an art. I wonder if you could kind of make it jive between the way Leo Garocha put together a team and the way a general manager using Saber would put together a team.
Well, you're probably thinking of the book he did with Ed Lynn called Nice Guys Finish Last.
Yeah.
Because there's been, I mean, Pee Wee Reese had a great quote about, you know, what was left out of that book.
Oh, yeah, there was another biography that was written about. I read the biography first, and then his autobiography.
Well, you know, there's got to be a mix, you know. I mean, Leo was a guy, I met Leo only once in a press box in spring training in Arizona, and he was very crotchety, and he's an amazing character. But if you gave him good players, he would find a way to win, not always within the rules, you know.
Well, I mean, he always famous was for taking people like Eddie Stanky, who couldn't hit, couldn't field, couldn't run.
All he knew was how to win.
Yeah.
You know.
And then I looked up Stanky, and I found out he always led the league in on-base average.
That's right, and walks, yeah. He was a great walker. he tried to manage. He was, I think, his managerial career was one day in 1977.
Houston.
No, Texas, the Rangers.
Texas.
The,
yeah.
Yeah, he just saw the players today, and that was 1977. You imagine what it's like today. But a good manager like La Russa, Davey Johnson, will know how to get something out of these prima donnas, you know.
I think the last person still in baseball who was directly connected with Leo DeRocher was Larry Boa.
I'm not. Well, I don't think Boa played for DeRocher. Well, I don't know. I mean, but you know, DeRocher was quite a character. Let's, you know. All right, we. Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up. You guys are scouts and have been doing it for a long time. But can you describe how much you look internationally now for scouting, not only in like the Caribbean and Latin America, but maybe abroad?
With us, it's become very big. Matter of fact, we put on Steve Wilson, if you remember, the left-handed pitcher. He pitched for us, and he pitched for Texas. He's our scout out in the Pacific Rim. And we've signed a good number of players in the past 5 years because of him out of Korea. Uh-huh. We've signed some players out of Japan, and he lives out there. We put a good deal of money into that, and you're starting to see in the major leagues now some of these players, what they call posting and out of the Japanese league and coming across. But there are more and more players. If you look in our farm system, we have a good number of Korean players. So it's not only Latin anymore. We have a player, I know we had a pitcher signed off Team Italy that time, and there are scouts all over the world now.
Right. Billy hit that. We have an international department. And, you can see it's becoming worldwide. I think there's still some talk about having a worldwide draft, you know, because there's so many players in different countries. And I think everybody has an academy now in the Dominican Republic. But like you say, though, that's, you know, South America, Australia has players. And like you say, the Italian team, look at the Yankees. You know, Francisco Cervelli is a prime example of the international player from other countries. Not traditionally,
but same. You referred to the degradation of the game in the Northeast here, that between players not wanting to stay here and going south, and weather conditions affecting. As a youth coach, do you have recommendations of what, when the players come asking, do I play AAU, where can I go to find extra exposure, extra playability, often due to the fact that you reference the equal number of games between Division I, whether it's Northeast or South, but weather often affects that. You get more doubleheaders in the Northeast because you get rainouts and you have to make up games. You often have 3 games in a day, often at the end of the season, just to get it in. What do you recommend to these players here in the Northeast to get extra exposure as far as possibly getting signed?
Well, what happens, it's a little different today. First of all, you have indoor facilities today, which when I was a kid, you didn't have. You can take kids to indoor batting cages, and they have mounds, or they have, I know in Flemington, New Jersey, they have the Jack Cuss complex. That's the most beautiful complex I've ever seen. That thing is huge. I mean, so kids in our part of the country now are starting to play 12 months out of the year. They have winter leagues in these places, and that's not the only place like that. So, but I'll tell you what, over the years I've heard many parents sitting at games saying, my son has to go to a Division I school, he has to go, he has to get that scholarship there, and I tell him, no, let your son go to a place where he can play, because that's the only way to get better, and always look at baseball as part of your college experience, and if you're good enough, then maybe you'll be fortunate enough to be one of those players that gets signed later on. But if you're not, at least you got an opportunity to play. It's no fun working out all week and not getting into a game. There's no guarantee if you go to a Division I school that you're going to play. You could say, okay, I'll sit my freshman year and my sophomore year, but I'll play my junior year. What's to stop that coach from recruiting somebody else or bringing in a player from a junior college? So I would tell parents all the time, Let your son go wherever he might have an opportunity to play, and the scouts will find you. We sign plenty of kids from Division II, Division III, junior colleges. If you can play, like I said earlier, we have a network of people. We contact coaches. This time of the year, we start sending letters out for schedules to coaches, and they recommend to us players, and we run those things down. So wherever you might go, but here in the Northeast, is more opportunity to play 12 months out of the year, or at least work out, and hit and throw and field that you didn't have years ago. So kids don't have to go running down south anymore.
Nick, would you rather see a player in a high school game, a local high school game, as opposed to going to a perfect game complex where they have these scouting combines where there's 200 other scouts? I mean, I would think that a player that's playing in a game that's surrounded by so many scouts is not going to be playing at his best that day.
Well, I agree with you. Because,
and has that made it easier for you to see talent also?
Well, what's happened? I've been against a lot of these combines and things like that for the fact the kids today don't learn the game. Years ago, they used to play in all these games, and you as a scout would go to see them play during the summer. And what you have today is I call some of these kids workout players. They learn how to run the 60, they learn how to throw, but they don't develop baseball instincts. They don't know the game. They're not playing on teams during the summer. What their parents are doing, they're paying a lot of money to take them to these so-called showcases every weekend. They travel someplace else. And these kids aren't learning the game.
There's a huge one in Jupiter.
Oh, I know. Yeah, we know all about those things.
They've got 500 golf carts driving all over the place.
And you
can't
have
I can't imagine a child or an adolescent or even a young college lady even playing.
You have every scouting director. There must be 500 scouts. They come from all over the country to go to Jupiter, let's say, for instance. They just had this thing in Jupiter, what he's talking about, maybe a month ago. And you get top players from around the country, and they play under these conditions. And they're not, they're just kids thrown on teams together. And to me, they're workout players, you know, and there are a lot of mistakes made. At draft time,
have teams relied on that, though?
Yes,
they
do.
They don't have the manpower to go look at pounds, so we're going to have to just do it this way?
Yeah, I said to you before, they've extended the scouts' areas. Mm-hmm. So they go, and the bosses go in to see these things. It saves them a lot of traveling. And I don't say they eliminate players, but they target certain players for the following spring from these things that they know they have to go and see.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Joe.
Well, I agree with everything that's been said, and like I say, it's always also to some extent. I mean, as a scout, to me it was wonderful to go down there and see 115 teams and that many players. Nobody was taking any of these showcases and giving a tremendous amount of money the next day. But to see that many players and at those different showcases, like he says in Jupiter or some of these different showcases that have a tremendous number of teams, there's also a tremendous number of college scouts. So it's not about just seeing one player or seeing, you know, follow the 100 golf carts that are going from game to game. But some of these showcases, to me, have their place in the overall scouting picture. And like I say, the draft is not held the very next day. I know for myself, it was very helpful the fact that come the following spring, if somebody was having a good day, or you started to hear a name, and I could say, well, I saw that same player 5 months ago in October in Jupiter. So, you know, one of the big things we want to do in scouting is to develop history. I mean, before I go into that draft room and recommend that we give somebody, you know, millions of dollars, then if I ask, you know, telling my owner that we want to take this kid, he's going to say, well, how many times did you see him? Well, I just saw him last week one time. I mean, I'm not so sure I'd want to give that kind of money out to somebody. So you do try to develop a history. Well, I've seen him at these different showcases. I saw him last year. I saw him 2 years ago, and he's really developed, and therefore we get that projection going. So I do think that it has its place. But like Billy said, you know, some players and some people said, well, I'm going to develop into that showcase kid who can do the things, the tools that we like to see, but they cannot play the game. When it comes to actually playing the game, they're short on that. And so they've developed just those tools. As an example, there were a few pitchers that eventually got drafted and got eventually drafted pretty good. But at the end of the summer, I asked them, well, how many innings did you throw? Probably about 18. 18 innings because they've gone to 6 showcases and thrown 3 innings at each showcase. Where his development, to me, was held back because he didn't play on a team and got himself, you know, 60 to 80 innings in, you know, as far as playing in the summer. So that certainly has taken its toll when it comes to development of players. So, I mean, everything that's been said to me is correct and right in some extent. But as you know, some of these different showcase events, it's become an excellent time to see a tremendous number of players at one time.
Yes?
First of all, thanks for coming. It's been really informative, really good to hear you guys' experience. But when you guys hear about a name or a player you guys want to check out, how many at-bats typically do you guys use to evaluate and so you can make a decision? Does it vary? And does it matter, like, the pitcher is pitching that day? In terms of just, like, evaluating hitting?
It's all taken into account. First of all, you're right. You do have to look at the type of competition that hitter is facing. I've gone to games, and Joe's gone to games, where you're going in to see a hitter, and they may walk him intentionally. All four times up, you may not get to see one swing, or you may swing and foul the ball off.
See, that's the big league, Bonds.
But, you would try to get there early and see if they take batting practice. Here in the New York City schools, there's no BP. Some of them don't even take infield. They just catch a couple of ground balls before the game. So sometimes you'd have to ask a kid if he would hit after the game for you. But again, Benny's not facing live pitching. He's facing somebody throwing BP and throwing a couple of cookies up there. And, he's going to try to hit it as far as he can. But you do look at the level of competition that they play against. Typically, like I said, if you get to see a player, and you try to see a hitter maybe three or four times in the spring, and you figure with three or four at-bats, so maybe 10 at-bats. But you do, as Joe said, have a history with them. You're not going in there probably that one spring and say, okay, I'm making a decision. Hopefully you have seen them along the way. Sometimes you don't, and you do the best you can.
There's something that was mentioned before, and when you're evaluating a hitter, I think that every scout might have their own little checklist, but bat speed is one thing that we like to see, and I think you can see that, from just taking some swings. But I also think that, it was mentioned before, I'm not sure if it was Joe DeLuca or Billy, mentioned about, as you have more and more experience in the game, you have a database of all the players that you've seen. And so you can refer to that database. I know myself, today, as opposed to maybe 25 years ago, I have a much more lengthier, deeper database to draw from. If Billy were to call his office and say, I just saw a player that reminds me to a T of Manny Ramirez. Well, if I was his boss, holy mackerel, I've heard of that. I want to see that player. But maybe 25 years ago, when he said, I just saw a player that really looks like a good hitter. Well, who's he remind you of? Well, I don't know, And as an older scout now, we have to keep up with our times because if I write down, he reminds me of, Mantle, you get it from a young boss, I'm not sure who that guy was, So you got to kind of stay up on our times. But as an older scout, you have a much broader base to see and database to draw from.
Yes?
Yeah, a lot of people talk about an intangible like makeup, and I figure with your experience, you are well suited to be able to evaluate that. And I'd just be curious, Billy and Joe, how do you define that notion of makeup, and what are some of the positive examples of things that you could cite as, things that impress you about a young ball?
Well, believe it or not, let's say you go in to see a pitcher. I don't want to go in and see that pitcher dominate. I want him to have maybe one bad inning where I want to see if he's going to either stick his head in the ground or he's going to say, give me that ball, let's go. And sometimes you don't get to see that because of he may be dominating, the level of competition that he may be pitching against isn't that good. But sometimes you see that. And I look a lot at body language. How that player, that pitcher, or whoever reacts when he gives up a base hit or he gives up a run, or how he reacts to his teammates. We've gone and seen players, and I don't want to give any names, but you have all 24 players sitting on this part of the bench, and that kid's sitting by himself because he's not friends with anybody on that team. You're looking at makeup. You're seeing how he gets along with teammates. I'm usually one of the first people at the ballpark. I'm usually there when the kids are showing up. I want to see them when they get out on the field, who goes out, who's fooling around, who's taking it seriously and getting ready for the ball game. And there's a lot that goes into that. And you know, Joe does it, and I can do it at this point because we've seen so many games over the years. Believe it or not, we might have the name of a high school player. And we're standing there when the team's bus pulls up, and the kids come off the bus, and you don't know who the kid is. And 9 times out of 10, I'll pick out that kid as he walks off the bus. I'll tell you who I'm here to see. Never seen the kid before in my life. Just from his physical attributes to the way he carries himself and the way, most of the time in a high school, the star player everybody looks up to. And you can see the way they react. But, you know, you get to see that, as Joe said, after so many years' experience, you can do those things.
Well, he said it very well, very well. But I also think that in a makeup situation, if you try to talk to them, you know, there's so many things that are going on today that didn't happen years ago. And that is, you know, we've come up with questionnaires to try to maybe get some insight on what they was, you know, what their feelings are. And I've also think that today there's more conversation that goes on between scout and player prior to the draft, so that, you know, you get maybe an insight on that as far as makeup. And also, everybody kind of, it's one of those subjective things, you know, what's good makeup or bad makeup. You know, we've mentioned Tom Giordano, who's, you know, in his 80s and he's scouting, and he is a great scout. And there was another one, you know, Ralph DeLulo, you know, who was a great scout. And he relayed a story to me that I've always kept when I was a free agent scout, and that was, if you're going to go, you know, sometimes you want to see 2, 3, 4 games that day. So you want to go see that, you know, as many players as you can. You've got a great weekend lined up, a 10 o'clock game, a 12 o'clock game, or 3 o'clock game. And he relayed a story of a pitcher who pitched in the major leagues. I know his name, but it's not fair to maybe throw these out. And he said, but what I learned from it, because he said, Joe, when you're scouting, you should tell the coach, if you're going to see a player, if you're going to leave early. Because then they see 3 or 4 scouts folding up their chairs in the fifth inning, and they would say, well, they may not like what they see, you know, or something like that. But let them know. And I took that because he relayed a story one time when a pitcher was out there throwing a no-hitter in the fourth inning. And that pitcher pitched in the big leagues and won many awards. And he went out there throwing a no-hitter, and so a lot of the scouts started folding up because they had to go get another game. They saw what they wanted to see, and they wanted to try to see as many games. And that pitcher yelled from the mound, hey, where are you going? I got a no-hitter going.
It's a true story.
He knows who he is. Well, one scout might think, hey, that's disrespectful. That's brash. You're yelling from the mound. And another scout might say, that guy's got something.
Right.
So, exactly. So, makeup can also be a little bit subjective in how you interpret that. So, one scout might say, hey, I don't want this guy. He's a non-respectful guy. He's going to be, if he's yelling at this game, he's going to yell in another game. You know, another scout might say that.
I'm going to tell you a real quick story. It's about a player that just pitched in the big leagues. He just retired, Billy Wagner. I went to see him in college. He was at Ferrum College in Virginia. And I was cross-checking then, and I go in with my scout to go see him. I was driving back from Florida, and I stopped in Virginia on my way home to New York. And Billy was pitching, and it was an away game. And I'll never forget this. And they had the opposing team's fans were on the third base side. And he had one of these fraternities. They were yelling and screaming at him and really razzing him. And it was about the fifth or sixth inning, and this kid had enough. He threw a pitch, and something happened, and he charged off the mound towards the stands and started yelling and screaming at him. And I'm sitting there as a scout, as a cross-checker, saying, this guy's nuts. You know, really. But you saw his desire. But myself, watching him that day, I'm saying, I don't know if this kid's going to be able to handle pressure, something like that. And yet he was an elite closer in the big leagues, but he showed you the fire, but you don't know if he can control himself.
Yeah.
What's a crush?
Okay. You have, on the amateur level, you have an amateur scout that may have the area of, let's say, New York, New Jersey, and New England. And then we have the scouts down in the Mid-Atlantic, and you have scouts in Florida, and you have a scout, let's say, in Georgia and the Carolinas. So what happens is we're all turning in reports. Let's say you have 30 reports, he has 20 reports, he has 30 reports in. You need somebody, and that's what a cross-checker is, to go to see all these scouts' players and rank the players. who's number one? Is the kid from Boston the first guy on the list, the guy in Florida second, the guy from North Carolina third? So that cross-checker is the guy that goes to the various full-time scouts area and determines in what order, you know, you're going to possibly draft that player. That's what a cross-checker
is. The cross-checker also, you know, is that second level, let's say, where the area scout, and then he'll develop his list over maybe 7 or 8 states, and then the cross-checker would probably have about 15 states. And so, for example, if you were the scouting director and I was your cross-checker, and Billy, Jay, and Lee all had areas, maybe from New Jersey to Maine, had the Carolinas, and had Florida. Well, Lee can tell you what he considers to be the best shortstop in Florida. And Jay can say, well, this is the best shortstop I have in the Carolinas. And Billy would say, this is the best shortstop I have in the Northeast. And you would tell me, now you rank those 3 shortstops because you've seen all 3. You know, the one, let's say, disadvantage of even of a area scout is that he's scouting, I tell even to the players, you know, we're scouting the unknown. And that is the fact that I can only rank the players I see. I haven't seen the players out west or in a different area. And that's the same thing. You know, that best player in the Northeast or, you know, may not be the best player on the East Coast, because the cross-checker is going to be able to see more pitchers, more shortstops, and then develop his list.
And generally, you have a battle with the West Coast guys, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And the Florida guys, right? Because they play. But this is, as you say, it's beginning to even out a little bit with the college and schedule.
Right, and Billy would say the same thing. I mean, we have a battle, but it's a respectful battle. Yeah. I mean, they have players that they want to see in their own particular regions get better. And I think one of the things about scouting is that you do need, when you walk into that draft room, park egos at the door, and let's get the best player for the St. Louis Cardinals. Yeah. I mean, I've been in situations where, you know what, that sounds like a better player than mine. Let's get that guy. It doesn't have to come from my particular region or whatever. You have to do what's best for the organization, and I think that that's one of the things that we've been able to do, but certainly not unique. You know, one of the things is that you have 30 teams in baseball, and most people would, you know, it is a baseball industry, but you've got to consider that also being 30 companies, right? And they're different, just like you have the computer industry and you have different companies that compete. We're competing. We know ourselves as colleagues, but we're also competing to get our clubs better, because if our clubs get better, we get a chance to win and experience, you know, some of that. So, you know, whether it's, you know, scouting at the end, I tell you one thing, though, the area scout is going to probably know that player more than the cross-checker, because he's going to have more history than that cross-checker coming in, where I may see him on that bad day, and the area scout's going to, you know, tell me that that was a bad day. You know, we were fortunate enough to, when we drafted and signed Matt Morris, you know, Matt was 9-4 in his junior year in college at Seton Hall. He lost 4 games. And I brought in cross-checkers, and he probably had his worst game. Hit 3 or 4 guys. Still showed the good arm and the good mechanics, but, you know, it was a play at first base where a player dived into first base and hurt his shoulder, and it couldn't move. They had to bring an ambulance to the ballpark. And now we've got a half-hour, 40-minute delay. You know, Matt gets out there again, and now he's a little bit wild. He hit a couple guys, but the cross-checkers that came to see him, now we have our conversations. Look, I've seen this player 7 times, pitch great, and you can't, let's not go on this one thing. So, you know, one of the things about it, I think Billy would also concur, is that we wouldn't have signed players in the major leagues if we didn't work for some good bosses, because they've had the confidence in our reports, our evaluations, that may have agreed with them, and sometimes they didn't, but they drafted players for us as well. Because we write the reports, and we certainly can put up a strong case that I'd like you to take this player. But the scouting director ultimately has that pick, and rightfully so. I mean, his name is going to go on that draft. And so we may, you know, be credited, and rightfully so, because we know the players, we recommend them. But I've worked for some great bosses that have been scouting directors and general managers that have been, you know, that have had shown the confidence in myself and in the players that eventually got to the big leagues.
Well, thank you all for coming. I hope we put the human, personal side of scouting in front of you, and that they're not just the non-anonymous people with a shot from the cameras with the radar gun. And in a couple hours, it will only be 94 days to the beginning of spring training. Thank you all.